Hello and welcome to the Learning to Mum podcast, a podcast dedicated to talking all things being a mum and all things being a female. The latter I feel much more qualified to talk about. I'm passionate about the honest accounts, the raw reality, and all the highs and lows that come with motherhood. So welcome to this podcast hosted by me, Kelly Beaumont. I'm so grateful to have you listening to me today. Enjoy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to my kind of weekly check-in before I jump into the podcast. I will point out before you hear any noise, it's breakfast time in our house, and Ophelia is having her porridge with fruit. So if you hear any of the crazy noises, bang on cue, you know exactly what it is. It's literally the day before I put the podcast out there. And it's the only time that I'm really going to get a chance to record the intro. So just going to have to deal with the excitable noises in the background. I should point out that the podcast is baby chatter free. So if you do find it slightly off-putting, just be aware that when it jumps into the content, she will not be... she'll not be distracting things. Sorry. She is watching me, thinking, who are you talking to? Are you talking to me? So how has this week been? Well, firstly, it's been a bit crazy. We moved house last Friday, and typical... Oh, can you hear the cat as well? Yeah, just to add to all of this. We moved house last Friday, and in typical kind of house moving style, we didn't get confirmation until last minute. Hi, Herb. Yeah. So Friday morning was all quite hectic. And then, yeah, things moved relatively quickly. And then we were fortunate. I genuinely feel that this is just perfection, isn't it? I really hope that you can hear Herb, because otherwise I just sound like I'm responding to nothing. He does quieten Ophelia, though, so, you know, swings and roundabouts. And is desperate to go outside in, you know, in typical cat fashion. But obviously we don't want to let him go out too soon in fear that he won't come back. Although sometimes when he meows like that, I do question whether we should just open the door and let him run free. He does this when I'm kind of talking or singing or anything. I don't know, I think he thinks that I'm talking to him. Do you want to just pop out there, mate? Because you're fairly distracting. Good boy. So yes, quickly, let me kind of summarize. We moved house last Friday, as I've told you, for about the fifth time now. It was a fairly hectic day. We then, on the Saturday afternoon, we were able to give Ophelia to my mum, who had her overnight. She's unfortunately in our bubble for childcare. So she took Ophie for 24 hours and Charles and I literally didn't stop. We unpacked every single box. We even managed to kind of, I think, get some bits on the wall. So it definitely feels like a home already. So I really, really can't grumble. But it has been a bit of a hectic week getting things sorted. And obviously that will continue because that's what house moving is like. But we have so much more space, which is brilliant. It's just now kind of thinking about how we fill it. Anyway, in terms of my week with Ophie, it's been another good week, to be honest. It's been another good week. I had a bit of a moment the other night when I was feeding her bedtime feed. And I just started crying. I was just looking at her and watching her, and she was like gazing back at me. And I just had a moment where, not, you know, like the sobs, but you know where tears just roll. And I was looking at her thinking, God, I really bloody love this kid. And to be honest, I massively struggle with kind of, I don't know whether connection's the word, but almost kind of like showing my, I don't know, affection for other people. It's just something that I've always kind of struggled with, perhaps is the apt word. And to be able to look at Ophie and know how much I love her, and to kind of really show it to somebody, in the way that I do with Ophi. I mean, I'm absolutely smitten. I think that for me, it's been a real kind of lesson, you know, a lesson into kind of what motherhood is really like. And I always hoped that it would happen this way. But you, I suppose, yeah, I suppose because of the early days and how I didn't feel that immediate bond, which you all know about from, or if you've listened to previous episodes, you know that. And I think now to know that it's progressed and I can feel the bond growing daily. Oh, it's just really, really special. So yeah, I had a cry the other night, which was delightful. Came down to have tea and I was like, oh, so yeah, just had a moment. So that was nice. And then yesterday, I'm of the understanding that Ophi has decided it's time to drop her afternoon nap. So very in keeping with this week's episode, that she has, yeah, effectively, the last nap that we did was around kind of 4 p.m. in the afternoon. And she would just use it as a bit of a top-up nap, and it would usually be a contact nap. And I went to do it yesterday and she was just having none of it, absolutely none of it. And I persisted for a while, but it was quite evident that she was just not into it. So I kept her up and she was awake from 2 o'clock in the afternoon until about 6:30, 7:15 at night when we put her down for bed. And she was absolutely fine. There was no whinging or anything. So it definitely feels like that nap has now served its purpose and we're moving on to the next stage. And if you're into kind of sleep guidance and things like that, the afternoon nap is typically dropped between the 6 to 9 month mark. And a feeler is about 6.5 months. So bang on cue, bang on cue. But yeah, just another kind of milestone in her development, which is lovely, but also wild and just shows to you how quickly things progress with these tiny people. So I'm trying to soak up all the other things that I know in the not too distant future will depart from our lives. So yeah, I think, as I say, all in all, a good week. I start back at work more consistently next week, so it'd be interesting to see how things kind of happen from there. I've been working once a week, pretty much ongoing since December, bar the odd one. And then I, as I say, start working more consistently from next week. I kind of effectively return from maternity next week after going off at the very end of July. And then all the other things I've done have been what we refer to as keeping in touch days. And I'll talk about all of this kind of stuff in future episodes because I think it's really interesting, particularly for mums who want to be working mums. So I'll cover all of that stuff in due course. Herb is back, obviously. What else was I going to say? Oh, and with me going back to work, Ophelia will be starting nursery at the end of March. So that's the kind of next milestone. So again, more to talk about that. And I think because I know that that's coming, I'm really keen to get Ophelia into a really good routine. I think we're at a point now where she is going to be interested in her third meal of the day. So we've done lunchtime and breakfast for a while now. And I think she's at a point where she's ready to have tea as well. So I think that that'll be something that I talk about in next week's episode. Ophelia's very happy because I've picked Herb up and yeah, they're now kind of pretty much making eye contact. She loves him and I'm not sure that he's quite so smitten with her. So yeah, lots of changes afoot in the kind of not too distant future, trying to get myself into the right headspace, trying to prep Ophelia accordingly. But yeah, generally everything is pretty good at the moment. Still no sign of teeth or teething. I'm sure that that will be the next hurdle. But as it stands at the moment, Ophelia is a very content and happy little baby. She seems to be demonstrating a lot of signs of independence, although I'm sure, you know, there's still a lot of her personality to map out. But yeah, we're already starting to see that she's really content in her own company and doesn't need, you know, lots of attention. Maybe that's a byproduct of how we've parented in those early days. Who can say? Who can say? One to continue to talk about in the podcast. Anyway, I think that that's quite enough of a summary of our week. I will jump into this week's episode, which is all on the topic of sleep, one that I feel quite passionately about. I focus predominantly on the fourth trimester, and I touch a little bit on where we are current day, but I definitely will be doing future episodes that incorporate sleep, because I know that it's such a huge topic and one that I think parents battle with most consistently, because obviously sleep is such a huge part of all our lives. So I will continue to share our sleep journey. It's definitely been a prioritization of my parenting style, and Charles has been hugely supportive of that. Sleep very much dominates how our days go. And to be honest, I wouldn't change a thing, because it sets her up quite nicely for bedtime. But I will share all of that, as I say, in due course. For now, enjoy this week's episode, and I will speak to you all soon. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Learning to Mum podcast. This is episode 7 and is a continuation of the fourth trimester series, specifically on the topic of sleep. I was really keen to focus a specific episode on this topic because I think it's a huge part of learning to mum. For me, it was the biggest adjustment that I went through, and has also been, I suppose, where most of my learnings have taken place, where I've perhaps had to relax a little, relinquish some of my control at times, a lot of the times, and also has been where I guess I've been most hung up on my parenting style. And as I've kind of come out of the fourth trimester, a sleep kind of routine is absolutely been the forefront of my mind and formed a large part of how I structure our days, when other people look after Ophelia. When I say other people, I mean my husband or my mum, who's fortunately in our support bubble. I do give clear instructions around how I like sleep to be managed. And we'll come on to that, because I think it's a really interesting view as to whether or not you're quite firm with your sleep structure, or whether you kind of leave it very much down to day to day and things looking different on one day versus the next. So, as I mentioned, for me, sleep was the biggest adjustment that happened in terms of from not being a mum to becoming a mum. And I say that it's the biggest adjustment because I think the whole concept of becoming a mum is huge, right? It's this complete juxtapose to how you've lived life for a lot of people, certainly for me, up until the point of delivery and then this, you know, baby now being in your life. But I kind of think that I can deal with most things. But when my sleep is affected, I lose all sense of ability to rationalize, to think logically, and it also has a real impact on my mood. And therefore, how sleep was, particularly in those early days, had such a bearing on how I was feeling. And linked in with last week's episode that looked at kind of mental recovery, for me, I think mental recovery took longer because my sleep was kind of thrown up in the air so much. So I really just want to talk about this topic because I feel that looking back, my view on sleep perhaps wasn't in the most beneficial place, I suppose, in terms of looking at things positively. I think I put a lot of pressure on me and I put a lot of pressure on Ophelia, and I don't think I recognised the adjustment that happened for Ophi and therefore why her sleep was so rare, let's say. So in this episode, I want to talk about my reality, what I went through. I want to talk about some of the things that I've learned since being a mum and knowing more about sleep. And I'm going to talk about how we have got to current day. And current day for us is a clear structure of daytime sleep, awake windows, rough nap times, feeds, milk, so feeds being food, milk, and set bedtimes with a view that now we are on day, I want to say six of sleeping through the night. So not waking for feeds during the night. And when she does wake, just stirring slightly and needing a tiny bit of resettling. But I would constitute it as sleeping through the night because she doesn't fully wake up during them times of needing settling. Now, what I don't want to do to myself is lure myself into a false sense of security that this is now our norm. Because I think the biggest thing that I've learned about sleep is that it varies from week to week, month to month, development stage to development stage, and so on and so forth. So I will kind of touch on where we are current day later on in the episode, just for, I suppose, continuity purposes in this topic. However, a lot of what happens current day, I will come on to in due course in future episodes. I kind of want to start right at the beginning, and that's the kind of where I'm going with all the episodes at the moment. So if you've listened to previous episodes, you know that I'm trying to work through things chronologically. Okay, so let's start right at the very beginning. Some of this will kind of incorporate things that I've discussed in previous episodes, but I think just in the context of talking about sleep as a full topic, it's important I kind of link in those aspects as and when it's right to do so. So I suppose right from day dot Ophelia being born, as you would expect, sleep was very inconsistent. Everything was devised around and structured around feeds. So her waking up or being aware that she needed to be fed. And as Ophelia was a breastfed baby, a lot of her feeds were kind of quite long. Her sleep time was fairly kind of short, comparably, I guess, to what I'd expected. And then she would kind of wait to be fed again for a long period. So I think that there's something really cruel about the kind of phrase sleeping like a baby, because I think you get into your mind that babies have this kind of really, deep sleep routine. And if they're sleeping like a baby, does that mean that, they're sleeping for long periods of time? They're in a really nice deep slumber. And I guess my experience of that has been quite different. Ophelia doesn't seem to fall into very deep sleeps when she does. So in those early stages, when she was sleeping, we did find a lot of the time we were having to, I don't know, almost tiptoe around her. And we certainly couldn't, people were talking about you could do the Hoovering and things like that. We definitely didn't find that we were able to do that. So a lot of what we were doing in those early days is just literally maneuvering ourselves around when Ophelia would sleep. And I think what I found really challenging was the fact that it was so unpredictable. So I would try and get my head around the fact that, okay, so she's just been feeding for an hour and a half. Surely that means that I've got at least a couple of hours before she wants feeding again. But that just never, I guess, the consistency never took off. It was completely varied, feed to feed, sleep to sleep. And I found that kind of inconsistency really challenging to navigate around because it felt so difficult to plan anything. And when you're somebody who has spent a life planning, you get to 29 years old and all you've ever done is had structure and routine and planning. And knowing that this kind of sleep piece is now the absolute, it's God, it's gospel, and everything is devised around that. And the fact that that was, as I say, so inconsistent, I found really tricky to navigate around. What I should say at this point is Ophelia's sleep was completely dependent on whether or not she was attached to somebody. So the first kind of 24 hours in hospital, I put Ophelia in her, like the little cot that they give you to put next to the bed. And I was like, oh my gosh, this this little girl is so independent, she doesn't really need to be cuddled all the time. That quickly changed. So even I think in hospital after the first few hours, it was quite evident that she wanted to be held and snuggled and, all the things that you would typically expect from a newborn baby who is completely unaware of what's happened but doesn't like what's happened essentially. And as I mentioned in previous episodes, that's okay in those early days, or maybe like the first 1 or 2 days. But when you start realizing that that's your reality, that the only time your baby will sleep is if they're attached to somebody, and usually attached to mum, that was really bloody difficult. Because I guess the question is, when does mum sleep? At what point am I meant to go to sleep? And I remember the midwives come around, and then that kind of moves into the health visitor after I think about day 10 when the midwife signed you off. And they would come around, and I would always say, I'm just not sleeping. And they'd be like, yeah, I know, it's really tough, isn't it? It's so tough. You've got to sleep when baby sleeps. And I remember kind of looking at them as if to say, are you joking? Are you joking? Because in one sentence they were saying sleep when baby sleeps, and in the next they were challenging the kind of whole safe sleep, the safe sleep structure, and telling you that you can't sleep with baby on you, and you can't sleep with baby next to you. Baby needs to be in a cot or a like Moses basket or next to me or whatever. And I would be sat there scratching my head thinking, how on earth do you do that? How, like, if your baby will only sleep on you and you're not allowed to sleep with your baby on you, when do you sleep? And honestly, it contributed so heavily to where I was in kind of my mental state and how positive or otherwise I was feeling. And I just found it so contradictory to be told this, that whole concept. And I remember speaking to my husband and my mum about it and just being like, I do not understand what I'm meant to do. So what we kind of did in those early stages, and I'm so grateful that I had a partner, and I'm so grateful that my mum was around, in between working and things like that. But what we would do is I'd feed Ophelia, as much as I possibly could, to the point where she would kind of fall asleep almost on the boob. I'd then burp her, hand her over to child for my mum, because we knew that typically once she'd fed to sleep, she would have a sleep. Who knows? Nobody knew for how long, but we knew that we'd get a bit of sleep. So I would hand her over, and I would go and grab as much sleep as I could. And what was also really cruel about that, and I don't know how many people can relate to this, when your brain knows that you've got a finite amount of time to sleep, your brain doesn't let you sleep. So I would go upstairs knowing that I maybe had an hour and a half, 2 max, and I'd be like, right, I just need to sleep. I just need to sleep. If I just get a bit of a top up, I can go again until the next time. And I just used to fight with it. And that, it all kind of manifested in this really poor situation in terms of the fact that I just felt I was continuously sleep deprived. And when even when I was given opportunities to catch up on sleep, I just wasn't in a position to make that happen. And then obviously mum wasn't there all day. She would come for maybe, a little bit of time, because I was so conscious that people would literally just need to be sat on the sofa with Ophelia. Like, they literally couldn't move. So if they needed the toilet, no, because the minute you put her down, she would start crying, which would then wake me up if I was lucky enough to have fallen asleep. And then I would have to come down and settle her by feeding her. And it was just so, I mean, it was just crackers, absolute crackers. And I remember, like, before I would go upstairs to sleep, I'd be checking everything. I'd be like, is your phone close enough to you so you don't need to move for that? Have you got a drink? Do you need anything? Can you reach the remote control? And it just used to, it was like a military operation every time I wanted to go for a nap. And as time went on, I remember Charles and I kind of getting agreements in place that I would go and have 4 hours to myself to go to sleep. And this was when I'd started to kind of use some of my milk that had leaked and that I'd contained in a bottle, and Charles would feed her that if she woke up. So that gave me a little bit of extra time. But at the time, we were living in this kind of three bed semi new build where the walls were paper thin. And anytime you hear your baby cry as a mother, particularly, you're alert, you're awake. And it was just, oh my goodness, I just felt there was absolutely no escape and that sleep was just fading away. And I just remember looking in the mirror and thinking, good Lord, like, I look like a zombie, like I actually look like a zombie. And that combined with the fact that I was having iron transfusion, so I was already kind of looking anemic or whatever else, it was just awful, just absolutely awful. And I was just getting so worked up about the fact that I just couldn't have sleep. And many of you will know that sleep is the kind of catalyst for all other aspects of life. So whether or not you have a healthy diet, whether or not you have the energy to go out for a walk, just absolutely everything. And because that component of my life was missing, it felt like all the other building blocks are out of sort as well. And I just couldn't find my rhythm. I just felt so overwhelmed from it. And I think it got to a point where I was like, I just don't know how much longer we can go for in this kind of world of Ophelia needing to be attached to us. And I remember there was times where, and again, I've spoken about this in previous episodes, where I started to resent this need for attachment that Ophelia had. You know, this, whilst I was completely aware why she was wanting to be attached to me, I just couldn't comprehend that I couldn't do anything, let alone sleep. It was just a real, real tough time. So I started to speak to my husband around what do we do in terms of this safe sleeping versus survival. Like for me, that is a real, conflict of interest. You know, yes, safe sleep is an absolute priority because keeping our daughter alive and well, I mean, that's the purpose of our existence now. But I can't do those things if I'm not surviving. And because sleep can have such an impact, as I've mentioned, on all of those other areas of life, I just didn't know what to do. And we'd purchased one of the sleepy heads. I think they've been rebranded as something else. So apologies if I'm not, you know, up to speed with the times. But we'd got a sleepy head. And I said to Charles, we're just going to have to let her sleep in it. And I remember I'd put things on Instagram and I'd get people's inputs and I'd really like some of the comments and then other comments wouldn't reinforce what I was looking to do. So then you were back to square one questioning yourself. And I think sometimes it can be so blooming dangerous to put your thoughts out into the world because you expose yourself to the arguments of support, but the arguments against what it is that you're trying to do. So I would put on about sleeping, putting Ophelia in a sleepy head to sleep, and people would kind of come back and say, you know, they haven't said that it's safe for babies to sleep in I was going to say unoccupied. Not unoccupied. Oh my gosh. See, I'm still dealing with baby brain, or at least that's my excuse. But essentially, unaided, or you know what I mean? Like, you can't just leave them sleep in that and then leave the room. They wanted you to kind of constantly observe. And I remember saying to Charles, well, that just defeats the object. Like, why would I put her in the sleepy head if then I just need to stay awake and watch her? We made the decision to let her sleep in her sleepy head because it would essentially cocoon her and give her this sense of security that she would get from being close to me or Charles. We then introduced a white noise machine, which we still use now, just background noise to help settle her. And in those early stages, it's meant to replicate the kind of noise that's continuously there when baby's in the womb, because obviously they can hear your heartbeat, but then there's all the kind of water that surrounds them. So they constantly have this noise. So where possible, you're trying to replicate the experience the baby had in the womb, which is obviously why they like to be close to you because you're warm, they can hear your heart, they can smell you, etc., etc. So we started with the sleepy head, the white noise machine. We tried a swaddle. She just was not into it at all. It's like she felt trapped. It was bizarre. I was like, well, come on, this is what happens. We're replicating the womb. And she just wasn't playing ball with the swaddle. But I know so many people have a success with that. But there's just so much contradictory guidance out there that I think sometimes you just have to have a really open dialogue with whoever you're doing all of the sleep routines and things like that with, i.e., if it's your partner or a family member, or just if it's you independently. You need to have a real kind of honest conversation with yourself to say, how much of the guidance am I going to take into consideration when I'm making my decisions? And I'm absolutely not sat here saying be ignorant, because I completely understand that there is so much out there in terms of making sleep safe for your babies. But sometimes the extent in which we go to protect our babies, or at least in our, in our experience, not allowing her to sleep in the sleepy head just was a step too far for us. And we did our research and we'd not read anything kind of horrific that came to sleep in the sleepy head. So the payoff felt more, it was pulling in favor of allowing her to sleep in the sleepy head. So we did that. And eventually, I think we started doing that around week six, I want to say. So up until week six, it was literally survival. Letting her sleep on us, whether that was me, whether that was Charles, whether it was when my mum could pop round, just wherever she could sleep. And I just literally, the word survived is the only one that's on my mind at the moment. I literally just survived that period. And that's it. I looked crap pretty much 24/7. I lived in the grey pants that I spoke about from Amazon last time. Oh God, I survived. And I have to tell you, I couldn't have been more grateful for the whole pandemic at that point, because I didn't have to host, I didn't have to entertain, I didn't have to pretend that everything was perfect, because I could just be. And I think anybody who is going through being a mum, or who intends to do it in the future, in whatever way you go about doing that, my advice to you is just soak up your time in your little bubble away from her, away from guests. They can come around when you're ready. The priority is absolutely that, when you're ready, and that differs from person to person. But for me, having guests around meant having to host or having to be a little bit more alert, and I just didn't have that in my reserve. And I think that that was the best thing that we ever did, or could have, the best situation we could have found ourselves in. So absolutely consider that if you're trying to. We didn't have people around for weeks, and obviously we were limited to what we could do, but we just, and I know because of the strength of, I don't know, I am very comfortable in my decision making. And I never second guess myself a lot, for the majority of time. Motherhood has, made me do that more than I ever have done historically. But I knew that I was never going to have guests round, no matter who it was. The only person that I felt that I could be 110% myself with was Charles and my mum. So they were the only people. And that doesn't mean that I don't love the rest of my family, the rest of my extended family, and my friends. It just means that there's always those people that you feel that you can be completely vulnerable in front of, and those are the people that you need around you in those early days. So I was really strict on saying, I don't want, I need to get to know Ophelia before I can invite other people around to get to know Ophelia. So that is one piece of guidance, or at least my story that I'll share with you, so that you can feel comfortable knowing that if you do feel like that, you're not alone. So obviously I've lost my train of thought now, but the premise being that it got to about week six of just survival, and then we started to introduce the sleepy head. So at night times, I would have the sleepy head in the bed or on the bed with me. Charles would be in another room. I would be in the king size bed with the sleepy head kind of at the bottom of the bed, facing the other way, so she wasn't completely next to me and I couldn't roll onto her. Not that I was in the habit of rolling around too much at that point. I think as soon as I fell asleep, I was like, good, an hour's sleep. And Yeah, we just let her do her thing in the sleepy head. I mean, sleep still was, it didn't go on for long periods of time. It was kind of short snippets and stints here and there. And Charles and I would then kind of balance the nights out. So I would take the first portion of being awake, and then Charles would take the second portion. And it would allow us to have at least kind of, I don't know, a 4 hour, 4 to 5 hour window where we'd be allowed to sleep. And I think the knowledge that you had longer than an hour allowed you to fall into sleep quicker because you weren't under this pressure of trying to get to sleep quickly, or at least that's what I found. And then some of the other challenges that we had in those early weeks was settling. So I was that crazy mum driving around at like 10 o'clock at night with Ophelia in the car seat to try and settle her. And 9 times out of 10, that would work. And again, it just goes back to the point that I was talking in terms of survival, that anything to get your baby to kind of settle and feel comfortable. And there's something about a car seat, isn't there, that makes them feel really snug. And I think maybe one or two of those times I was able to transfer her then to a sleepy head and we'd get a few hours sleep on top of that. But 9 times out of 10, she would wake up from being transferred from the car seat to the sleepy head. So it's crazy, isn't it? Just the recognition that you have to lean into the fact that sleep is, the opportunities for sleep are few and far between, but you can steadily start to introduce a little bit of structure and a little bit of routine. But I think just being aware of what those first few weeks demand from you, and to be really kind to yourself in terms of the information that you absorb and the arguments for and against safe sleep, and having a really open dialogue with whoever you're having, whoever you're sharing your sleep journey with, as I said, whether that's a partner, family members, friends, or independently. I think you just owe it to yourself to be really kind. And it's not about poo-pooing the guidance that's out there in terms of safe sleep, because I absolutely am not a professional enough or a professional at all to tell you to ignore any guidance. But I think sometimes the level of deviation that you have away from your ability to sleep yourself, I have to question whether or not that is safe for baby as well. If you're running on continuous empty and you're not able to function, but you maybe need to drive to the doctors for their jabs, like what's the payoff? So just take into consideration the whole argument, not just safe sleep for baby, but I guess safe parenting for you as well. But do what's right for you. What else did I want to say? Oh, yes, this is controversial. Okay, controversial alert. We, at around about week 10, had, as I said, we'd from about week 6, we'd introduced the sleepy head, we'd done the white noise machine, and we were in a fairly good place for longer sleep periods than we'd had in those first 6 weeks. But we still weren't seeing the success that I guess we anticipated we would around that point. And obviously, every baby is completely different. But I spoke to one of my friends who had a baby who was about a week behind, or a week or 2 weeks behind Ophelia. And I'd made a comment around Ophie sleeping on her back because that's the guidance. And I said, I just don't think she's comfortable on her back. When she sleeps on us, she's sleeping on her chest, she's sleeping kind of face down, and that's where she's really comfortable. And when we put her down and watch her, like if we're on the sofa and she's fallen asleep, and we're trying to get into the habit of removing her off us so that she can learn to sleep more independently, we put her face down. But obviously, when it comes to us falling asleep, we don't do that because it's not safe. And my friend said to me, okay, this is really controversial, but if you put your face down, what do you do if you can't breathe? And I was like, well, I move my head so I can breathe. And they said, well, exactly. And that's the same for baby. Now, I know that that is a really controversial statement because babies dependent on their age are completely capable of doing different things. And this is why there's no one size fits all. And I think you have to do what's right for you, and you have to be really cautious about new things that you try, particularly this example. So Ophelia was 10 weeks and we would allow her to sleep face down watching her, and she would stir and she would rub her face into whatever she was sleeping on, and then she'd move her face to the side again. And that would happen every time she would sleep on her tummy. So we would watch her put her face into whatever she was sleeping on, face down, and she would move every single time. And then I would purposefully put her face down when she'd gone to sleep on my chest. I would purposely put her face down. It sounds really cruel, but let me talk you through it. Instead of moving her head to the side when I was lying her down. And every time I put her face down, even in that kind of deeper sleep, she would move her face to the side. And I said to Charles, I feel that we just need to try it. We just need to try it. And we did. We went for putting Ophelia face down. And she'd shown us that she had arm strength. Even at that young age, she'd shown us that she could lift herself and move her head. So we were doing it with the knowledge that we'd seen Ophelia demonstrate that she was capable of moving herself into a position that was safe. So we did it. And it was a game changer. It was an absolute game changer. I think we'd gone from having, 2 hours of independent sleep, bearing in mind we'd gone from not being able to have her off us to transitioning to her sleeping in the sleepy head for a little bit longer, but independently. And now we were at maybe 3 to 4 hours of independent sleep around about week 10 because we'd put her face down. And I remember saying to Charles, oh my God. And I got really emotional about it because obviously that is not in the parameters of safe sleep. And this is where I feel that it's really tricky being a parent in a modern day world where there is so much guidance that is available to us on demand. I guess there's more data out there to tell us the pros and cons of everything. And if you went back years and years and years ago when all of this stuff was just trial and error and motherhood was survival and whatever worked for you, I feel that babies would have slept face down. And I think that that used to be the guidance, didn't it? I mean, don't quote me on that because I've not done my homework, but I'm pretty sure that it was more encouraged then than it was now. And I'm definitely not even going to touch on the topic of SIDS and all that kind of stuff because I just don't know enough about it. So do not use this episode as gospel guidance, or please just make sure you do your research, whatever you choose to do. But just know that this is my story, as it always is in these episodes. And for us, putting Ophelia face down was a game changer for us. And on that note, I am going to go get her because she's just woken up from her morning nap. Bang on cue, 30 minutes. Very apt for the fact that we're talking about sleep. And yeah, she's just coming round now from lying on her tummy, I may add, and looking up for somebody to come and get her. So I will pause there and I'll come back to you in just a moment. Hello, I'm back. So Ophelia has just gone down for her lunchtime nap. It's about 12:15. So I'm gonna try and kind of cram everything that I can into this lunchtime slot. So I'll round up the podcast and then also eat lunch, and I've got some work to do. And yeah, lunchtime is where you try and cram everything in. There's still an element of unpredictability with her lunchtime naps because sometimes she wakes up after the 45-minute cycle and needs a lot of kind of intervention, and then other times she can sleep right through for an hour and a half. So you don't usually know what you're going to get. It's very much luck of the draw. So I'm cracking on quickly so that I can eat my lunch and do whatever else needs to be done. So I kind of finished that last segment talking about sleeping face down. I don't want to say too much more about it other than that's what worked for us. We put in parameters that we believe allowed us to safeguard and ensure that Ophelia was okay to sleep like that, and we've never looked back since. She continuously sleeps on her tummy. She has the capability of being able to roll over now, and she doesn't. She sleeps face down. That is her chosen method of sleep. So that's what works for us. Do your homework and decide what works for you. I think from that point forward, we didn't really look back. I think once you start getting a taste of having sleep again and having a bit more flexibility with things, I find that then you want more and more and more. So that was very much the kind of catalyst for me wanting to look at developing Ophelia's sleep patterns for nighttime by understanding what needed to happen during the day. So quite early on, I decided to have a conversation with a sleep consultant. Now, the thing to mention at this point is having any form of real structure or any expectation of a routine in the fourth trimester is unrealistic. There is so much going on for baby. They're really developing their sleep pattern, sleep routines. They have no circadian rhythm. They essentially don't have a mature capability when it comes to sleep. So having too much pressure in those early days is going to set you up for a bit of a fail, because you're going to be striving something that isn't really attainable or achievable. So what I wanted to do by speaking to a sleep consultant was to understand how I could best lay suitable foundations in order to set us up for success as and when Ophelia, her sleep cycle matured and a routine was much easier, I say that in inverted commas, to obtain. And for me, that was a worthwhile investment of money. I don't think that it was extortionate to have a one-to-one. We spent time talking about what I'm trying to achieve. We spoke about where Ophelia currently is. I got a really good knowledge, understanding of how sleep works. And it just helped me to feel really informed. My parenting style, I guess, is one that likes to look at a range of different things, but also understand baseline facts. And from there, I then, with Charles, work through what, you know, we want to do, what we think is best for Ophelia. And obviously that is a very unique journey, person to person, parent to parent. But the sleep consultant conversation felt right for me. So I spent time understanding that. We were then given a kind of sleep plan, very kind of robust sleep plan. I suspect it's very much like for like whoever it's distributed to, because the foundations of sleep and what you're trying to achieve tends to be pretty consistent across all babies and, yeah, whatever you're looking for, there is a usual kind of set of guidelines as to what encourages a healthy nighttime routine, and that's about setting up the daytime positively. Now, what we did from around about the 12-week mark, so once they kind of step out of the fourth trimester, you can then start steadily introducing a bit of a routine, because they've become able to stay awake for longer periods of time. Their sleep pressure doesn't overly build up as much as it used to, so they have the capacity to be able to stay awake for longer, which means that when they do go down, in theory, they can sleep for longer periods at a time. And by doing that at night, you can then start to have a bit of a rhythm with a nighttime routine. And the first thing that came into play for us was having a set bedtime routine. So quite early on, we began integrating a kind of wind down, taking her away from any kind of blue light. So taking her from the front room setting upstairs into the bedrooms, where it was typically dimmer lighting, and the noise in the background, the background noise kind of settled somewhat. And then from about 6 o'clock, we would start to put her in her bath. So we would undress her, put her in her bath, 10 to 15 minutes in the bath, washing her down, kind of talking to her and things like that. She would come out of the bath, she would be moisturised, her hair would be brushed, she'd be put into her baby grow, into her sleep suit, and then put into her bedroom. And I would lay her in her cot and I would leave a light on in the bedroom, like a silhouette light with a red red lighting, which is conducive to sleep. And I would put her in there, I would go make her bedtime bottle, I'd then come back up and feed her. Now for me, that felt like it was instigating structure. It was showing her that every night when she went for a bath and then got dressed into her sleepy bag, that that was the kind of sign that sleep was coming. In addition to that, I felt like leaving her in her cot and leaving the light on showed to her that I was going to return, so that she knew that being in her cot was safe and suitable for her. Now, she didn't sleep in her cot at that point. She was still sleeping in a next to me. So we transitioned from a sleepy head to a next to me as she slept face down, because the sleepy head is not conducive to sleeping face down because it would be too enclosed. So we moved to a sleepy head. and yeah, I would feed her at about 6:30, 7:15, and then put her down at about 7 o'clock. Typically, she would settle. Sometimes it takes longer than others. And we would, yeah, that would be her nighttime routine. And obviously, there's been different variations of that. Sometimes she'd wake up after a couple of hours and want feeding and putting down again. Other times she'd sleep for 4 hours, need feeding and putting down again. And it was kind of peaks and troughs throughout all of that period. I should also mention two other things. The first one being what's referred to as the witching hour. Sometimes that pushed back or moved forward the bath time routine. I found that kind of getting her into that structure was the only thing that really settled her. The witching hour definitely kind of passes by about the third trimester, I think. And there's no real kind of science behind it, other than a lot of people think it's developmental and it's, you know, psychological as the day's gone on and it's transitioning into night. For me, it was a very real thing and it happened pretty much daily for a period of time. So yeah, that would have a bearing on whether we did a bath at, I don't know, 20 to 6 or 6 o'clock or 20 past 6. So it wasn't always completely stringent, but we followed the same structure regardless. The other thing that I should mention is when Ophelia was really young and we weren't putting her down for a bedtime routine, we used to literally juggle who would hold Ophelia while eating tea. And typically it would be me. I would hold Ophelia while trying to eat my tea. And we just, I think now looking back, it's like, why were you doing this? We would sit with the TV on, obviously blue light, obviously noise, in the same room that she's being kind of up and alert in. And I would wonder why Ophelia wasn't settling. And obviously we just weren't creating the right environment for her to settle in. So I think that's something to just bear in mind. It's thinking about, is the environment, are the settings conducive to falling asleep? Could you actually, maybe that's not a good example. I can't fall asleep in front of the TV with loads of background noise. I know a lot of people can, but typically whatever prevents you from getting to sleep also prevents baby from getting to sleep. So it's really important to just consider that. But yeah, we put her down, had a bedtime routine, and have had a bedtime routine ever since. Ophelia will go to bed between 6:30 and 7 o'clock every night. And that's what works for us. It allows Charles and I to eat tea together more often than not. Obviously, as I say, it depends on whether she's stirring and needs resettling. But more often than not, we can sit down and we can have tea together, which is just brilliant. I also want to mention really honestly that we use a dummy and have done for, I think, from about week 4, perhaps. It wasn't an immediate thing, but it definitely settled Ophelia when she was beside herself from time to time, and it prevented me from feeding her when I think she just wanted to settle in. So we did have a dummy. I went through a really love-hate relationship with the dummy. Sleep consultants will typically tell you to go cold turkey with a dummy, particularly if you're finding that it's a hindrance. A lot of babies will relate certain things to certain things. So for example, a dummy might be associated with falling asleep or being asleep. So when baby wakes up and the dummy's not there, they will cry out until the dummy's replaced. And we definitely went through a period of that where I found Ophelia was more, it was usually the day as opposed to the night. She would wake up, the dummy wouldn't be there, and it would force her to cry and wake up from her nap. And I went through probably a week or two where I really battled with, was it the right thing to keep it or not? And because there was so much other change happening at that time, I decided to persevere with the dummy. That was the right decision for us. Everybody else has different views. That's fine. And I'm glad that I did, okay? Because those few weeks passed, and now I think it's fair to say, yes, obviously, it's frustrating sometimes. She needs it to settle. So she will associate the dummy with settling. So what happens is, let's use the bedtime wind down. She'll have her bottle and then she will moan a little bit. The dummy will go in and she'll associate that with falling asleep. So there is an association. But now Ophelia will wake up. And through the night, I mean, the dummy falls out. I mean, I'm looking at her now and the dummy's out. So I put her down and within 5 minutes, she has spat the dummy out and she stirs and she's not crying for it. That isn't always the case. If she's in a light sleep state, she will cry for the dummy. But now through the night, I find it's rare that she will. And she doesn't have the dummy at any other points. It's literally just as she's fallen asleep, she will use that to kind of soothe her. Now, and she doesn't have it, like I say, when she's just sat playing or any other time. And that isn't a judgment on anybody that uses it in a different way. But for us, it's working as a soother, and that's it. And I'm in no rush to get rid of it. I've got a comfortable relationship with the dummy now. When it comes to tea, then I'm sure that it will be a benefit if she's really beside herself. So that's what works for us, and I'm going to stick with it. The other things that we swear by are the sleepy bags. So for ages, I was against sleepy bags. I said to Charles, I just really like the idea of a cellular blanket. You know, I just think that they're lovely. I'm sure it was more a kind of aesthetics thing than anything else. But they can chuck blankets off themselves. They can get tangled up in them. Oh, they're just, yeah, they're not ideal for wriggly babies, which we have. We definitely have a wriggler. So the sleepy bags, I absolutely highly recommend. We have a couple of one tog and a couple of 2.5 togs. And they're really easy to use because they tell you and offer you guidance around, dependent on the temperature of the room. With the sleepy bag, this is what you should wear. So a sleeveless vest, a full kind of sleep suit. And if your room has a thermometer, or like us, you have the temperature gauge on your baby monitor, we swear by them. So we have a range of sleepy bags. We've just repurchased some from the Little Green Sheep. It's a company I absolutely love and have used their things right from day dot. So I think the other thing to mention before I kind of quickly give you a current day view is sleep progression. So this treads slightly outside of the third trimester because typically sleep progression hits at around 4 months. It can be earlier, it can be later. Remember, every baby is different. For us, it was about 2 weeks after her 4 month mark. So I think it was bang on Christmas Eve that it happened. Now, the whole kind of premise around the sleep progression is essentially their sleep cycle change. They mature and ultimately they have trouble kind of connecting their sleep cycles, which means that they then wake up and it's completely varied. Some babies will wake up after an hour, some 45 minutes, some couple of hours. There is no kind of written rule as to what will happen. But what most people will notice, dependent on where their sleep has got to that point, is that sleep seems to regress. That's why it's called the regression, because babies that were maybe sleeping 4 hours at a time go back down to two or go back down to an hour. And I think that the 4 month regression feels really cruel for mums and dads or whoever's waking up. But yes, it feels really cruel because ultimately you've got into a bit of a rhythm in how your baby sleeps and then everything changes. And if you're anything like me, I was kind of living in fear of the 4 month regression. I almost felt like I was counting down to it. And you know what? Maybe in hindsight, I wish I hadn't done that. But again, being aware that it was coming, feeling informed when it did, it almost kind of set me up for what was to come so that I was in a position to handle it. Hours lasted, I think, somewhere between 2 to 3 weeks. It fades into insignificance, to be quite honest. And yeah, in that time, I think I just kept holding on to the view. I mean, it was tough, like, let's not lie, but I just kept holding on to, when she comes through the other side of this, her sleep cycle is going to be in a more mature space, which will be supportive of better sleep. And I believe that that's true. Since coming out the other side of the regression, she now has better sleep cycles. Definitely at nighttime, she's a much better sleeper at nighttime than she is at days, although that is in an okay position. But yeah, I think it's just fair to say that the regression, try not to fear it, try to recognize that it means that baby is adjusting and moving into that kind of next stage of sleep. If you do want to educate yourself on sleep, I think it's really important to think about what's out there in terms of who you want to follow, what information you want. I will leave the sleep specialist that I spoke to in the notes of the podcast because that's the one that I found worked for me. She offers loads of free content as well. So if it is something that you want to kind of be aware of or educate yourself on, it's definitely worth taking a look at that. Current day, we have naps in the morning that last 30 minutes. We try to do a set wake up of between 6 and 7 o'clock in the morning, dependent on how the night's gone. Of late, she's been probably around about 6:30 because she's sleeping through. So she's waking up slightly earlier. We will then give her, I'll talk about all of this in more detail further down the line, but just to give you a flavour, she then goes down for a 30-minute nap at around 9 o'clock. I then try and keep her awake until about 12, 12:30. And the lunchtime nap is a game of bingo and we see what happens. Some days are far better than others. And then she is still currently doing a kind of late afternoon contact nap with me. I'm really kind of cherishing that contact nap because I know soon it's not going to be there anymore. Typically between the period of 6 to 9 months, that is the nap that is dropped. But I'll talk about that, as I say, in future episodes. And then, yeah, we stick to our bedtime routine that we've had from her young, young age. And we aim for between 6:30 and 7 o'clock bedtime. So conclusively with this episode, I just want to reiterate that the fourth trimester and sleep, they're not the best of friends, okay? Being comfortable and being aware that it's completely normal for your baby to have frequent wake windows and be incredibly dependent on parents or whoever are their safe people in terms of instigating and maintaining sleep. Be aware of safe sleep guidance and have a conversation with your support network to find what works for you in line with that guidance, but try not to be overwhelmed. A lot of what's out there feels contradictory, and I think the best advice that can be given is to ask questions, and with the information that you're given, focus on your baby and work out what's right. And recognize that they don't have a circadian rhythm in those first few months. So they don't really know the difference between day and night. They just know that they feed, they sleep, they wake up, they're hungry, and the cycle continues. It can feel so intense for mum and dad. I always say this, mum and dad and whoever else is involved, but it does, for me, it got better. And I believe that the reason that it got better is because I've been really informed around sleep. Now, I know that other people have different relationships with sleep, and I do feel that we've got a good baby, if there's such a thing. We've got a baby who seems to like to sleep, particularly at night time. So I'm certainly not saying that this is a kind of one size fits all approach. I'm sharing our journey. The last thing that I want to say is just be kind to yourself, be kind to your baby, and know that no matter who they are, it can be improved. There is support out there. There is so much support out there. And just talk to people. You know, when you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, reach out for help, because there'll be guaranteed some other mum sat there pulling her hair out, thinking, why did we do this again? Why did we do this? I love sleep. So just make sure that you talk to people. I hope that you found the episode useful as always. I would really appreciate it if you are so desired, goodness me, if you so desired to rate the podcast. Every kind of little helps, because it means that the more ratings it gets, the further out there it can be distributed. And as we know, these topics are so important for positive mindset into motherhood, because we know how bloody hard it can be. So please do rate. If you want to leave a comment on how you found the podcast, that's also really appreciated. And I will see you next week for another episode. I feel that from week to week, I'm just deciding what works for me. I'm trying to make it logical to what the last episode was all about, but I wish I could give you a flavor of what it is. But to be honest, I just work week to week at the moment. That for me is motherhood. So I hope you have a wonderful week. Thank you all for listening, and I will speak to you very soon. Bye bye. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Learning to Mum podcast. I hope you found it somewhat insightful, or it gave you a little bit of insight into the reality of being a mum. You might be able to hear Ophelia in the background saying goodbye too. If you want to hit subscribe, that would be really appreciated, and it'll mean that as new episodes are launched, they'll drop straight into your preferred listening. So, I'll see you all next week. Have a good one. Bye.